Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins. We have a wonderful show coming up for you today. Obviously, one of the biggest things we'll be talking about, the anniversary of the January 6th Capitol riot. We've got all kinds of new developments that have come from the Capitol Riot Committee. We'll be talking about all of those this week. Author David Pepper will be joining me to talk about his new book, Laboratories of Autocracy, which explains how Republicans, even though they don't control the federal government, are still able to get everything that they and their donors want by controlling state governments. And we've got even more listener questions from our YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. So don't go anywhere. Ring of Fire starts right now. Obviously, as I mentioned in the intro here, biggest news of the week, biggest thing that has happened, we just passed the anniversary of the January 6th Capitol riot. Now, Donald Trump was supposed to hold a press conference that day. He was supposed to come out and tell us how the real insurrection took place on November 3rd, and he decided at the last minute that probably not a good idea to do that. Reports say that Republicans were not thrilled with his idea to hold a press conference that day because, you know, he would go out there and say things that were completely indefensible. And we know that already because of the statement he put out when he announced that he was going to be holding this conference. He said that, as I mentioned, the real insurrection was November 3rd. The protest for that was what took place on January 6th. He was going to sympathize with the Capitol rioters themselves, and of course, he was going to spread more election lies. And Republicans, including Lindsey Graham, didn't think this was a smart message to send out to the public. And to be honest, I'm kind of shocked that they understood how damaging that message could be. Typically, they don't stand up to Donald Trump. But they did this time, and even more remarkable, typically Donald Trump doesn't back down when he's got an idea, but he absolutely backed off of this one. I don't know who exactly was in his ear, but they must have been incredibly persuasive in order to convince him to not go forward with these plans. And of course, Steve Bannon was furious about this. Steve Bannon goes on his podcast after Trump makes this announcement and says, "This is absolutely ludicrous. Donald Trump, you have control of the narrative. Don't listen to people like Lindsey Graham. They're always wrong about everything. Whatever they tell you, do the opposite." But Trump didn't listen to Bannon. And for the record, no, Donald Trump does not have control of the narrative. According to recent polls, a majority of Americans do support the work of the January 6th Select Committee. A majority of Americans think that the sentences being handed out for Capitol rioters have been too lenient. And that is also another important thing that we have to understand. Granted, in both those cases, for the record, it's very slim majorities. But it's majorities nonetheless. People want justice for what took place that day. And of course, that brings us to the January 6th Select Committee. All sorts of news from the committee since they reconvened this past Monday. We have Sean Hannity getting a subpoena, and we now know that one of the things they want to talk to Sean Hannity about was what he knew about Donald Trump's mental state that day. Now, for months, there had been rumors that some of Donald Trump's cabinet members had discussed invoking the 25th Amendment following the Capitol riot. Now, that obviously never came to fruition, but the riot committee, in their request to Sean Hannity, said, "We want to know what you knew. We want to know if you had any ideas regarding the discussed plan," I guess you could call it, "to invoke the 25th Amendment." Now, we don't know exactly what Sean Hannity could have known about anything like that. We do know, according to the text messages that have been made public, that he was communicating with Mark Meadows, communicating with them the day before the Capitol riot, communicating with him during the Capitol riot. So if anybody outside of that administration would have been aware of any such plans, it likely would have been Sean Hannity. Obviously, he was a close friend of Donald Trump. People called him an informal advisor, said he essentially had a seat in the White House because he talked to Donald Trump so frequently. So the question is, was Sean Hannity concerned about Donald Trump's mental state? Or was Hannity the one who got into the ear of the cabinet officials and told them to not move forward with this plan? And honestly, I believe it is the latter. I do think, to a degree, Hannity probably was concerned about Trump's mental state, but Hannity would never, ever, ever have gone along with a plan to remove Donald Trump from office using the 25th Amendment. That's not who Hannity is. In fact, one of the messages that has been revealed shows Hannity telling Meadows, like, we just got to cruise through the next 14 days. Because that's all Trump had left. So I highly doubt that Sean Hannity would have been one of the people saying, oh yeah, let's get him out of office with just 2 weeks to go. But it would make more sense to think that maybe, and again, this is all speculation because we won't know until it all comes out, but it would make sense if Sean Hannity was the guy talking to Mark Meadows and Meadows maybe said, hey, listen, we got a problem. They're talking about the 25th Amendment. We're trying to get through these last 2 weeks without removing him from office. Can you help? Is there anything that you can do? Again, to me, that seems like the most likely scenario here. But Hannity, of course, is fighting this request. His attorney, Jay Sekulow, has said this is somehow a violation of his First Amendment freedoms as a member of the press, which is seriously one of the dumbest legal arguments I think I've ever heard, because Hannity was not communicating with Mark Meadows as a journalist or as a member of the media. He was communicating with Mark Meadows as a friend. So no, there is no First Amendment protections for what could be subpoenaed here. So I'm a little shocked that they're even attempting to use that argument to try to get out of this request for his documents. It clearly is not going to work. Another individual that we learned has had their phone records subpoenaed is MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell. He confirmed to CNBC on Wednesday of this week that his communications via his carrier Verizon had in fact been subpoenaed, but not to worry because he filed an emergency injunction trying to prevent his records from being turned over. Lindell also has no legal leg to stand on here. The committee is trying to figure out who was involved in the spreading of the misinformation, because the misinformation is what radicalized these individuals to later go on and storm the Capitol. It's a big, you know, long chain of events that they are trying to establish. That is, you know, essentially what you would do in any trial or investigation. You have to establish the actors. You have to establish the chain of events. You know, the beginning, middle, and end. It's like you're telling a story. And Mike Lindell is a massive part of that story. He has been at the forefront of these 2020 election lies since the election took place. So it would make perfect sense for the committee to issue him a subpoena and say, listen, we need to know who you were talking to. Were you a part of any of these Republican plans that we now know about to somehow get rid of certain electors for certain states, replace them with Trump loyalists? What did you know? When did you know it? Who did you talk to? And what did you say? Those are the questions the committee is trying to answer here. And again, Lindell really has no recourse here to block this subpoena. Now, he tried to say in his statement to CNBC that, listen, I wasn't there, obviously. I wasn't even in the Capitol. You know, I wasn't a part of any of this. So, of course, my records would not be something they would need. But again, trying to establish the chain of events, the misinformation is the key to that. And you can't talk about election misinformation without talking about Pillow Guy here. You're the king of it. You've literally held two cyber symposiums, one in August, one in November, laying out what you claimed was all of the evidence, even though you didn't actually provide evidence, that the election was stolen, which it wasn't. So that's where that is. Now, a couple other developments from the committee so far this year. They have already said they're going to be bringing more of these hearings to television, which is a smart thing. I've been saying for months this entire thing should have been televised because it serves two purposes. First and foremost, it keeps the public aware of what's happening. But secondly, and this one might be a little more selfish, and you know, you can disagree with me on this if you want, but the second one is because the public needs to remember that this was Republicans. We're in an election year. And it's time for Democrats to, I guess you would say, fight a little dirty. Go out there and make these Republicans look as bad as they've made themselves look. Because you're not engaging in any kind of propaganda. This is real stuff that happened. And it was the Republicans who did it. So use it against them by televising all these hearings. So then this week, after, you know, the news said, hey, they're thinking about televising it, it was revealed that the committee is not just thinking about televising it, they're actually thinking about airing it in prime time. So this could be prime time must-see TV. You sit down with your family at the end of a long day, you've just had dinner, you turn on the TV, and boom, there's the January 6th committee right there on your television laying out everything they have. That is a brilliant idea. I love it. I hope they do it. I want everything moving forward to be completely transparent. One, because again, the public needs to be aware of this. And two, because of the political benefits the Democrats could get from this. I'm sorry, I am partisan. And the Democrats need to do that. But also, televising these hearings has a third benefit. It lets the public see firsthand how the process is being carried out. Because we have already seen the Republicans come out and try to tell us that this is a political witch hunt. It's all a farce. It's pure politics. They're not doing anything relevant. But if the public gets to watch it, they can see for themselves that, wait a minute, that's not the case. So you get your transparency. Everybody's caught up on what's happening. You get the political benefits from it. And you debunk in advance the Republican talking points by showing the public that it's not as, you know, partisan driven as they've been trying to make it. And that brings me to another story this week. And this one's a bit shocking to me. A new poll from USA Today and Suffolk University for the first time shows that most Americans in this poll, in this one single poll, I'll give you that, most prefer Democrats over Republicans heading into the 2022 midterms. 37% of people polled said they want Republican, generic Republican, to beat generic Democrat on the ballot in 2022. 39% said we want generic Democrat to be the victor. So it's only a 2-point gap between the two, but Democrats have the advantage. The poll has a 3.1% margin of error, so statistically you would consider that to be a tie. But here's the reason this is important. And again, it's only one poll. Maybe this is an outlier, maybe it's a fluke, or maybe it's indicative that things are changing. We won't know until more polls like this come out in the coming weeks. But a month ago, it was a 12-point gap favoring the Republicans. The same polling company at USA Today's Suffolk University, their own polls showed at least a 10-point gap that favored Republicans. And a month later, the Democrats now have a 2-point advantage. Folks, that is huge. Now, I have talked about polls basically ever since taking this show over. Because I love talking about polls because it does show us where things are headed. And of course, there were some other really bad polls coming out this week. Joe Biden is now underwater on his approval rating, has reached record high disapprovals on his handling of both the pandemic and the economy. That's very bad for Democrats. But I think what's also happening in this same span of time is that the work of the January 6th committee is becoming more public. More and more people are paying attention to what's happening. And of course, that's going to sour them on the Republicans. So, you know, that's why I'm saying televise the hearings, remind people who did this. And Democrats, you may have a shot of either not losing the House or maybe not losing it in that 70-seat projection that Republicans currently believe. And yes, for the record, congressional Republicans think they could gain as many as 70 seats this year. Democrats might be able to hold that off if they keep harping on this, but they could definitely stave off that red wave if they at the same time deliver for the American public. And I know I beat on that all the time because that's the most important thing they have to do. You have to give the public something to vote for, not just someone to vote against. So if you couple those two things together, the souring of the attitudes of the public towards Republicans, combine it with Democrats delivering for the public, and you may retain control of the House of Representatives. You may break that historical chain and keep your power. It's easier said than done, obviously, because the biggest thing is you have to deliver. Okay, these polls will be flipping constantly between now and Election Day. But if the Democrats can finally deliver something tangible for the American public, and yes, a lot of it hinges on that Build Back Better Act that Joe Manchin still is not 100% on. I don't even think he's 50% because he wants to kill the child tax credit and scale it down to where so few people get it that it's immeasurable. But if they can do something, if they can work out a deal, get some part of the Build Back Better Act, you might be able to win a couple more people over. But there's also things Biden can do without having to, you know, rely on Joe Manchin or Congress. And the biggest thing is you can forgive student loan debt. He's already pushed the ball down the road. You know, you don't have to start paying back in February. Now you get to start paying back in May. Bought himself a little bit of time with that. But buying time is not good enough. You have to relieve the suffering of the American public. And the only way you can do that is to forgive the loan debt, which for the record, according to estimates, would result in a net benefit of $86 billion in the United States economy every year. $86 billion in new economic activity by forgiving this student loan debt would generate a couple billion in tax revenue. Or we can have people keep paying money to the banks or to the government itself, you know, who, depending on whoever your loan servicer is. But that's a big win. And it's a win that is literally sitting there waiting for Joe Biden to claim it if he wants to claim it. You do not need Congress to do that. So if he does that, I do see a scenario where Democrats pull out major victories, unprecedented victories, to be honest, in the midterms. If he doesn't, then the Democrats better hope that the Republicans look a heck of a lot worse than the Democratic Party as we inch closer and closer to November. There is a good chance of that happening, but it'd be even better if this administration finally delivered something tangible to the American public. Now, let's get in to this week's interview. We have seen reports for the last year, state by state, these Republican-controlled states doing everything that they can to suppress voters, to marginalize already persecuted individuals. And they're able to do this because the state control that the Republicans have is so absolute that they fear nothing. And this was not an accident. And joining me now to talk about how this happened, and of course how we can fight back, is David Pepper, author of the new book, Laboratories of Autocracy. David, your new book, Laboratories of Autocracy, I think that is the perfect label for what we see happening, especially just in the last few months. with states around this country, but obviously this is something that's been going on for many, many years. So lay out to us, you know, your book here and your general thesis, because I love it. I think it's absolutely brilliant.
The book walks through how these states have really become, you know, what the title says, laboratories of autocracy. And by that, I try and emphasize in the book, they're not only hacking away at the pillars of democracy, you know, independent courts, they're rigging legislative elections, they're attacking things like the teaching of history, you name it, but they really are operating as laboratories where all these states are doing this at the same time. They're always learning from each other. If one of them tries something, doesn't work, all the other states pay attention. They do it differently. If something works and is held up in court, the other states model from that. They're sharing their best practices and lessons learned. So that's why it's accelerating, because it's getting more coordinated and they're sort of perfecting something that began, you know, a few decades ago, but they're perfecting it as they go and they're operating more in unison than they ever have. So it sounds almost like a, you know, overhyped title, but my hope is when people read the book, they'll see that it's a perfect description of what's happening right now in these states.
Well, and I think if we look at obviously one of the most recent examples of this with the Texas abortion bill, because you already have, I forget the exact number, but well over a dozen Republican-controlled states that have said publicly, if the Supreme Court upholds the Texas law, we are ready to follow suit. We have the legislation essentially already drafted. We're dealing with that in Florida. We're seeing it in other states across the South. They're ready. They're just Absolutely. Waiting on that go ahead. And Texas really was just kind of the petri dish of, we'll be the ones to test it out. And if we succeed, everybody else can follow suit here.
Totally. That's how it works. And I would assume some will pass it because politics favors some of them doing this even before there's a decision. But here's the thing. If the court strikes it down, they're going to read the opinion very closely to figure out exactly how to amend the law in their own state. So the next time it gets upheld, they're always learning from successes and failures. You know, the same thing happened with Ohio's purging process. We have a horrible process in Ohio of purging infrequent voters. A lot of states held back from doing that because it looked to be violating federal law. Well, the Supreme Court upheld it 5-4 a couple years ago. Other states have now begun it. And our Secretary of State, who defended this process, literally the day they won their Supreme Court case, said very proudly, we hope other states do the same thing. So they really are acting this way. And it is leading to terrible outcomes like that law. But it also means that they are doing it in across the board, attacking democracy itself. And one of the things I go through in this book is a lot of things they're pursuing, like that Texas law, in a world of normal politics, they would actually lose their office. They're pushing things that are very unpopular. So one of the things they all have to do to sustain what they're doing is really crush, you know, robust democracy. Because if you tried to push all the crazy stuff they're pushing, if it was a normal election in fair districts, they'd all lose. These things are extreme. They're in the extreme minority. So one of the areas that they're all learning from each other all the time is what is the best way to crush democracy? And we have I opened my book with a small example. In Ohio, while drop boxes for voting early have been popular and bipartisan for years, in Ohio, the Secretary of State actually banned all but one drop box per county. It led to really long lines. It led to traffic jams. People had to drive, you know, 40 miles to get to a drop box. In some counties of a million people, one drop box. It was a disaster. But if your goal is to keep people from voting who you don't like voting, it was a success story. What happened in the last year amid all the other stuff? A number of states are replicating this ban of all but one drop box per county. And so they always are learning from each other. And right now they are learning from each other how to best attack basic pillars of our democracy. It's obviously a very scary pattern we're seeing.
You know, it's funny to me that you pointed that out, because that was the point I was going to make as well, is that it's always the most extreme pieces of legislation here that get replicated from state to state. You know, a couple years ago, where we saw the legislation that said, hey, listen, we're going to make it legal for if a protester is blocking the flow of traffic,
right,
you're okay to essentially run them over.
Right.
And then, of course, after that passed, we started to see it pop up in the Midwest. We've seen it pop up down here where I am in Florida.
Yeah.
And that is just one of so many different examples. You know, another one could be the transgender athlete bans,
right,
that we see these people pushing that is addressing a problem that doesn't actually even exist, but it panders to the base.
Right.
And for some of these, by the time a court were to come and strike it down, everybody's already forgotten it even existed. And they're not going to pay attention,
right,
to the fact that it no longer is a law. They're just going to remember it had happened. And so that's another thing they get to do. Even, you know, we see this legislation that is almost designed to fail, in some of these instances too. And that is intentional because they know they can drum up this base. And of course, as you pointed out, learn from it, learn why it was struck down and say, okay, but we can redo it and address these couple issues the courts had, and then
right,
we're good to go with it.
Yeah. And I call it in my book, I sort of casual about it, but the 80-20 rule. They push so much stuff forward in all these state houses, and one or two of the issues will generate all the attention. It'll actually make the newspaper. And oftentimes that issue may get beaten up so much that they actually pull back. But in the meantime, there's a lot of other issues that no one focused on that pass that actually become law. And then those issues that become law are picked up in other states. So 80% of the things they push forward may not actually make it or may be struck down. But if all the states are doing it and 20% get through in state after state, and then they all replicate each other, they're always making progress. And and as I go through the book, there for a lot of reasons, people don't pay attention to these state houses. The newspapers, our state journalists are really being hurt by that industry falling apart and cuts. So there's that chaos caused by all these bills. Some get attention, others get no attention. You know, here's a great example in Ohio. We had all sorts of bills come forward, the kind you mentioned, last year. Maybe the most egregious attack on democracy in my standpoint, it's happening in the country. Our legislatures are starting to attack independent elected courts. And in Ohio, we managed to win a lot of these seats, Democrats did, by running smart campaigns and good candidates. Well, amid all the frenzy of things that got a lot of attention, the Republicans passed a bill that forevermore party ID would be on the ballot for Supreme Court and appellate judges. That's never been the case before. Why do they do that? Because they don't want to have anything but courts of their own party. You know, a huge effort to stop having a court that's a check and balance almost got no headlines. So there's like in that craziness, it's almost like a different form of misinformation. Create a huge mess, create a lot of controversy on one side, and on the other, slip in some things that really do hurt democracy while no one's paying attention, and then do it again and again and again.
You know, it's a great point you bring up, too, about the fact that, you know, people aren't paying as close of attention to these state house races. And part of that, of course, is absolutely the media. Even in areas where they do still have, you know, a local newspaper, they have their local news channel. Behind most of them is actually some big media conglomerate. You know, we have a local newspaper here in my small town, but it's actually a Gannett paper, and they run mostly stories that come from the parent. Our local TV channel is actually, you know, right, Sinclair Broadcasting. And so we get their propaganda coming through as well. So people are less informed, obviously, and these news outlets are focusing less and less on what's happening in your state, especially when we look at the last 5 years. Everything is national news because we came off those four horrendous years where everything Trump said, did, or tweeted, you know, was unfortunately newsworthy. And I don't think that was overhyped either. I mean, he was tweeting out horrible
right,
things, but now with COVID surging and all of this, everything that's truly affecting these state house races in an election year like this does get pushed to the side, and that's to
right,
the detriment of the American voters. And unfortunately, I think we're going to see even more of that this year, especially if the pandemic kind of keeps the rate that it's going, I know we're going to die down eventually, but if another variant comes out, that's the news. And these local races right. that are starting to shape up this year are going to get overshadowed again.
Yeah. I mean, the one way I'd put it is because of everything you just said, state houses are almost the Achilles heel of American governance. You know, they have a whole lot of power, and this is an important part of the book. And you know, you go back to the original Constitution. State houses are given enormous power over our democracy. You know, they choose the electors that go and choose the president. They draw the district lines of our Congress. They set the rules of elections. So they have a lot of power, but they're almost anonymous. One of my book chapters literally, with great power comes great anonymity, off that old Spider-Man quote. And the problem there is that's a really toxic and dangerous combination. They could do a lot of things, but no one knows about it. And who does know about it? The people who want them to do things with those powers that aren't good. And that's why I think you see the groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers, they have zeroed on in these state houses, zeroed in on these state houses, because they know they have a lot of power. They can do a lot of things, good or bad, but they can do it in a way that no one notices it. Or the elections for these state houses are so rigged by gerrymandering, even if they do them and it gets noticed, they never lose anyway. They're essentially guaranteed reelection. So it's this very unaccountable and anonymous level of government that happens to have a lot of power over economic issues, social issues, and also democracy itself. It's a dangerous combination. And that's why I wrote the book, trying to get people to pay as much attention to this level of government that can do so much damage if in the wrong hands, as opposed to, you know, we spend all day watching Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert. They not only aren't in the majority, they're not passing any laws. They make a lot of noise. There are hundreds of people just like those congresspeople in state houses right now in the majority, in leadership positions, passing laws, attacking democracy. We should not focus on the ones in Congress, but we should focus just as much on the ones at the state houses who actually are passing laws that really are impacting the democracy of this country.
Well, you know, you also bring up there, you've got your Koch brothers, you've got ALEC. ALEC has been at this for years because ALEC understands when you want to make real change, you do it at the state level. And part of it is because of that anonymity that you talk about. You know, what if we go and we change some rules over here in Wyoming, you know, so we can get some more fracking? Nobody's going to pay attention to Wyoming. And then, of course, we can go to another state and say, well, hey, look what Wyoming did. This right. opened up, created some jobs here. Exactly. This is great. And the Koch brothers, too, I believe it was 2016 election. We had talked about this here on Ring of Fire. They started pouring money into city council races in Pennsylvania. And when you start to dig in a little more, it's because they were hoping to open up areas for fracking in Pennsylvania, but they were so zeroed in on it that they knew the city council members right. to go after. And that's the kind of thing that happens, you know, not just at the state house, but sometimes it goes even more local than that with what these particular special interest groups and big money donors are targeting. And those definitely get overlooked by the press and, of course, by the voters as well.
Yeah, no, it's true. They've been doing it a long time. And, you know, one of the things I put in my book is, you know, take a rounding error of the amount of money that we spend on the Democratic side for a presidential campaign. And if you dedicated, you know, 5% of that, and said, we're going to spread it out over 4 years to cover 50 states and offices at all levels. You know, that could help you focus and elect people at the state house level or other levels. And by the way, if you did it, I think you'd actually be in better shape in the presidential election because you'll have more of an infrastructure. And my guess is people who are giving at the presidential level are thinking, well, that's crazy. We would never do that. And the answer is, well, that's what the Koch brothers did. They figured out that actually spend a little less, if at all less, in the presidential, but invest enough money in all those local races where $10,000 makes a big difference, as opposed to being a drop in the ocean at the higher level. You know, put $20,000 into a state house race. do that in states across the country, like Ohio or others. And with the Koch brothers made that bet, and it's absolutely worked to a T. They've locked in control of state house after state house. And with the control of the state houses, they get everything they want to do economically done. All these state houses are doing trickle-down economics, deregulating everything. So they get that done. But they also now have their hands on the levers that control democracy itself, because state houses have those powers too. So their investment has paid off in spades. And on our side, we still haven't quite caught. People are catching up to it, but we're years behind the mind shift that has to happen. You know, we need to reframe how we think about politics right now for those of us who care about democracy. And that is to make it clear that that's what this is about. This is a long battle for democracy. Will we have a robust democracy, or will we have something that looks like what Hungary has now, competitive autocracy, where most things are predetermined by election rigging and gerrymandering and voter suppression? That's what the battle is. And if you think about it that way, it means you're investing in 50 states, not only swing states in a federal year. And it means you understand this is a long, long game we're fighting, not just a cycle by cycle game.
You know, I think it's also important to point out, too, when we talk about these corporations and these special interests who do pour money like this into the state house races, as you said, you don't have to spend as much. Those races typically are cheaper. And then where do a lot of the federal politicians come from? Well, they come from the state house.
Right.
And at that point, it's almost like the big moneyed interests are buying stock. You know, we bought in when it was cheap.
Right.
And now once this person tries to go for a higher office, maybe they want to run for U.S. Congress. Maybe they want to run for Senate because they've got good name recognition in their state. We already bought into them. So right. We don't have to pump as much money into them as if they were a new person. They're already on our side. So that's another part of the investment, because these, you know, state house people typically, and I look at my district here because Matt Gaetz is my congressman.
Oh, boy.
And that's where he came from. That's where a lot of these people come from. Ron DeSantis as well. So it's a good investment for these corporations, a horrible payout for the American public. But you buy these people cheap and you own them forever.
Yeah. And the culture that they're coming from are like Florida, Ohio, hyper-partisan, more corruption than any other level. So the breeding ground is now a place that has people in these offices who've never really been about public service. In fact, one of the things in the book I talk about is we're now at the tail end of the first generation of politicians. And I don't know all your Florida ones, but I can say this confidently, Ohio. Most of the people in the majority of the Ohio State House have themselves never really been in a real election. The election, their district was rigged in 2011. They weren't going to lose ever. They maybe won a primary at some point, got like 6,000, 8,000 votes. Since then, they've never had an election. Democracy isn't a part of why they rose to power. And frankly, a lot of them know that. They know that if they actually were ever in a real democratic system, they're so extreme, and many of them are tied close enough to corruption, their public outcomes are not defensible. You know, towns falling apart, schools falling apart, power grids collapsing in Texas. It's all part of the same corrupt state house culture. In a real democracy, these people would lose. And they themselves have never actually had to win a real election. So that's the generation that's kind of coming to power. And yeah, it should scare us that a bunch of people just like that will also end up in Congress. Because if they themselves have never been through a democracy, if all they've known are rigged districts they couldn't lose, if they're in Congress and they're asked to vote on things that would protect democracy, of course they're not going to. All they've ever known is a lack of democracy. It's a really scary, and I think we're starting to see, because people always are surprised by how bad these legislatures are. And when you realize, well, it's because none of them have actually been in a democratic world their whole careers, it shows you how warped the politics gets when that's what these people have been experiencing. They you know, I had to win a city council race in Cincinnati. I won a swing county commission race. I know what it's like to go and try and win a real election and talk to the actual swing voters. These people haven't done that. And so the very notion of a competitive democratic system where they have to earn an office is foreign to them. And in the end, it scares them. And that's why they work so hard on rigging districts so they can't ever lose.
Well, you know, and you and I obviously have a little bit unique perspectives on this, because as you said, you're in Ohio. We have seen horrible legislation at the state level from Ohio. I'm down here in Florida. We have it as well. So what I do wonder, and I don't know if you even have, you know, opinions on this or not, but there is a bit of a, you know, we've experienced it, so we understand how scary it is, how threatening it can be, and what it does to democracy. Do you think there's a disconnect between some of these folks that are in, you know, the solid blue states? They don't have to go through as much of this. And so maybe they just don't think about it as much. I mean, what's your opinion on that?
You know, the second half of my book title is A Wake Up Call from Behind the Lines. And it's actually saying, I want you to hear from people who are living in states that in many ways no longer meet a definition of a functioning democracy. I mean, that sounds dramatic, but it's true. It really is the case, at least at the state house level. You know, Florida, like Ohio, I think good Democratic candidates can still win statewide, but the state houses are rigged. They can't be lost under the current situation. That's not a democracy. And I do worry that maybe folks in blue states, they've already sort of given up on states like Ohio and Florida as forever red. And I would say to them, we had a Democratic state house as recently as 2010. It's not like that was that very long ago. They rigged it in 11, so that would never happen again. And I wrote the book to explain that it's much worse than people appreciate the consequences of what's happening in these state houses, to try and wake folks up. And when I watch Washington and the fact that they put voting rights behind other key pieces of legislation, and now I see talk that maybe we'll do, you know, electoral count, college count reform instead of broader voting rights. When I see that, that's when I think they don't know how bad it is that in many of these states, you no longer have a democratic system. And that should be unacceptable. I mean, in fact, in the Constitution itself, there's a clause of the Constitution that says the United States shall guarantee a Republican form of government in every state. The founders said we must ensure there's democracy in every state of this country. And that's what I would say to anyone in a blue state. And by the way, a lot of blue state folks have had me on, and they're very concerned like we are. But I do worry that there's almost, well, that's a red state. They're going to be run by a Republican legislature. And that, too, may be true. But the result of this rigged, corrupt system is that we're not being governed like the moderate state that we are, Ohio. We're being governed like we're the most far right state in the country. It's way out of whack with where the people of Ohio are. I go through in the book, you know, everything from Roe v. Wade to gun safety. They're legislating in the Ohio State House, and I'm sure this is true in Florida, in a way that only 30% of the people support. They're on the side of the deep minority for Ohio. But because of the way the political system is set up, there's no accountability, so they can keep doing it. They don't represent Ohio, whether or not we're swing or a little bit red. What they're doing is like Alabama red, or way far to the right red. It's not Ohio, but in a system of a rigged, you know, legislature, they can do it and get away with it.
Right. When you have the one party in power, the Republicans that get to, at the state level, change the voting laws, they get to rewrite the districts, they get to make the rules, and they get to say, okay, well, look, we know we don't have a majority of the voters, so how do we make it to where our majority, as you've pointed out, stay safe? And that's what you've seen in Ohio. It's what we see in Florida. It's what they're trying to do in, you know, Georgia and Texas and all these other states that, you know, could be purple. And in fact, the population suggests it is way more purple than people realize. And then I see, you know, like what we've seen this week with Texas. Texas comes out and says, we need the federal government to help. With Omicron's going crazy, we need the federal government. And you see these folks on social media saying, well, you deserve this. You're getting what you but you can't have that attitude. You cannot. You have to understand this affects everybody out there. And it drives me crazy when I see people with the, oh, well, you get what you deserve. No, this is absolutely a horrendous circumstance here. And something has to be done about it. These states are far more purple when you get down to the people than a lot of folks understand.
Here's these legislators, they don't reflect the people of their states anymore. So when I hear, well, you get what you deserve, these are people who are guaranteed re-election. I mean, I put in the book, 60 of the 99 members of the state house, 60 Republicans, for 10 years averaged double-digit victories. Most of them averaged 20 points or more. So it's these states are no longer about the people of the states. These legislatures exist on their own, doing what they're doing, immune from the people. And that's the problem. And that's something that should trouble anyone from any state, that you have states that, at least at the legislative level, you essentially no longer have what anyone could describe as a functioning democracy. That's one reason, by the way, that when major economic interests or anti-democratic interests, when they want to get stuff done, they go through the state houses because they know these state houses will do what they ask without any worry of re-election. A mayor would probably lose election if they did some of these things because it's unpopular. So these are anti-democratic institutions. They have no connection back to the people of their states or their districts anymore. And so they become the perfect sort of breeding ground of all the worst legislation. If you want to get something really bad done, basically, you go to the state house. They'll do it and they'll never lose their election. And that's something that, again, and here's the problem. Even if you said to yourself, well, they deserve it, as the founders worried about, these state houses have enough control over the nation's democracy that by being undemocratic in states doesn't only damage the states, it risks the entire nation's democracy. And that's, in the end, the real threat, is that if these state houses continue what they're doing, they can mess with enough of the overall nation's voting that they can turn what they're doing and nationalize it. And that's why Donald Trump, who was he calling when he wanted January 6th lead to a different outcome? State houses, because they have the power over the electoral college process. And so even if you're wrongly saying they deserve it, when these state houses no longer even reflect their people, the risk is even bigger than just what's happening in states themselves. It's to the entire country.
Well, and hopefully, you know, with midterms this year, obviously state house elections as well, hopefully people understand this. Hopefully we can wake some folks up. And of course, I think the best way to do that, pick up a copy of this book, Laboratories of Autocracy, A Wake-Up Call from Behind the Lines. So, David, real quick before we go here, tell people where they can find you, social media, whatever
sure.
You got.
Thanks again for having me on. I'm very active on Twitter, at David Pepper. And you can go to laboratoriesofautocracy.com and see a little bit about the book and buy it through there. I also recently started a YouTube channel as well, David Pepper for Ohio, the number 4 Ohio, where I try and do a lot of explainer videos about what's happening, which people seem to find helpful. So any of those places, go to them and check them out.
David Pepper, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much. Take care.
And that's it for this week's Ring of Fire. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And don't forget that you can get the full show. Just go to rofpodcast.com, sign up, and become a member. It is absolutely the best way to show your support. You can also support us by going to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire and subscribing. We also have wonderful membership tiers if you would like to be a participant in that, or you can check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/TheRingOfFire. I'm Farron Cousins, and you can find me on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, all of them at Farron Balanced, a name actually conceived by Sam Cedar himself all the way back in 2007. I'm still riding strong with it today. But on behalf of everybody here at Ring of Fire, we do once again want to tell you Happy New Year. We got a lot of work to do in 2022. So let's get to it. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.